Well, I guess we can get started. Looks like, could I ask the other people online just to introduce themselves?
Mark Bacon here from Air Products.
Hi, Mark. Hope you have WebEx. Sorry your email bounced.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'm fine.
Oh, okay, good. Next, anyone else?
With a couple of colleagues.
Great. Okay, good. Anyone else?
Kevin Mahoney from Praxair.
Very good. Anyone else?
Vikas Goyal from ExxonMobil.
Okay.
Also, with some colleagues from AB Copper Research, Switzerland.
Very good. Okay. All right, any others?
Jock Willow and Jeff Dunbank from Air Products.
Great. Okay. Good. All right, so let's get started then. It's my pleasure to introduce Victor Zavala, who's also joining us by WebEx. And so Victor is at Argonne National Laboratory. He received his PhD here at Carnegie Mellon a couple of years ago. And he's working on control of energy systems. So his interests lie in control and optimization of nonlinear systems, as well as estimation and uncertainty quantification for chemical and energy and power systems, including the smart grid. So he's won numerous awards, been a keynote speaker at DICOPS 2007, and is currently working at Argonne in these areas as a computational mathematician in the math and computer science division. He's going to be talking to us about the interface between chemical and power industries, and so, Victor, it's all yours.
All right. Thank you very much, Larry. So first of all, thank you. It's a pleasure for me to share some of these ideas. And I think more than trying to work this as me in a single direction and trying to provide some ideas and insights, I'm also very interested from the government perspective on what is the current situation in pricing structures, in particular in some of the sites in the U.S., and try to figure out what would be some of the benefits that the chemical industry could have from better rates, better contracts, better pricing mechanisms. And so at the end of the talk, I will leave a little bit of space for us to discuss some of this. So, okay, so let me start. So I'm a chemical engineer that happened to start working on energy, and I started finding a lot of synergies into some of the technologies that we can use, that we have used for a long time in chemical industry, in the power industry. So it's very interesting because the power industry has been dominated, of course, by mostly electrical engineers, and nowadays things are shifting a little bit into mechanical engineers. Chemical engineers are becoming very active participants, and in particular, process systems engineering seems to be provide some very interesting tools for them, and so we're seeing some interest from their side. So if we go to the second slide, I'm proposing here some particular outline for the talk. So I'm just going to give a brief motivation of how things seem to be evolving in the power grid, what I call the next generation grid. Some people call it the smart grid. And I'm going to try to motivate what could be the role of the chemical industry in different aspects of how can the chemical industry in particular can contribute to make markets more efficient. And we will see that they actually could play a very interesting role. So then I'm going to talk about market operations. The general market structure, it changes quite a lot from region to region in the U.S., but there are some basic similarities into how pricing is established. And so we will see things like day-ahead markets, real-time markets. And then I'm going to talk a little bit the mechanisms that the chemical industry are using or could potentially be using for pricing electricity if they decide to go with price taking, where basically they just observe prices, or if they could take a more contractual point of view through bids. So I will talk a little bit about what will be the implications of that in the operations. The operational opportunities, definitely there's a lot of opportunities from the chemical industry. One of the fundamental problems in the power grid is that storage is very difficult and very expensive. So in particular, the U.S. has very limited storage capacity. We don't have as many hydro plants. So all this push for smart grid is precisely trying to make demands a little bit more elastic and faster to react, so that we can mitigate a little bit the lack of storage capacity. And especially, we will see that what are the implications of that. But from the chemical industry perspective, if you have a very large site, we actually have a lot of degrees of freedom through the material inventories. And I will talk a little bit about what will be the potential of actually exploiting that into the way we operate the power grid, and how the utility companies could actually benefit a lot from that, and what could be some interesting mechanisms for pricing inventories. And then trying to motivate a little bit of that, I'm going to just find some analogies or propose some analogies from building energy management, so that you understand a little bit some of these ideas and some of the optimization needs that I'm going to discuss a little bit of what could be some interesting insights. So the motivation, so the current grid, it's operated mostly what I call in a one-way direction. So what happens is that you have some big central plants that are trying to provide electricity to all the consumers. The utilities are there in the middle. But basically what you have is a big power station sending directly electricity to office buildings, to factories, houses, hospitals, and apartment buildings. So most of the electricity in the U.S. come from coal plants and nuclear plants. So especially from coal plants, CO2 emissions are a big concern. One of the problems with this framework of pretty much the consumers being price takers and just taking electricity as it comes is that the demands are quite inelastic. The consumers never see prices, in particular, I mean, industry is a little bit different, but in particular in buildings, for example, prices are not observed in real time, so people don't know what to do at what time, and there's also limited electricity storage. So now with all the plans that the government is pushing into 30% renewables in 2030, one of the problems is that the grid is not flexible enough to sustain the variations of wind. So, and in particular, the contingencies that have been striking the grid, that's a big problem. So you want to figure out ways to make the grid flexible from an operational point of view, from the design point of view, just to try to absorb some of these contingencies. So now I'm going to the next slide, on the motivation. So here is just to illustrate how quickly we can observe some variations of renewable supply. That is one of the main drivers of all this work. So in this graph, what you will see is in the top part, I have the aggregated load for the entire state of Illinois over a period of time of 120 hours. So you see, you notice some clear periodicity there. But one of the very interesting features is that the load actually it is quite smooth. So the changes do not occur at a very high frequency. So and this is quite surprising, but it actually, when you aggregate all these loads, you will see that there's some smoothing effect. But one of the problems with wind supply, especially here, I'm plotting some wind power supply that was coming from Iowa, is that the frequency of variations or the frequency of this signal is actually pretty high. So what you can see, there are some events called wind ramps. So for example, at time 40, you will see a wind ramp just moving almost from full capacity to almost no capacity at all in less than 5 hours. So in less than 1 hour, you can observe very strong changes, 10 to 20% of the total capacity. So this is a concern because the central power plants cannot sustain this. And so what we need to do to sustain these variations is, instead of looking at these base plants, is using natural gas plants that are faster in the way they ramp. So they can, they're smaller and the thermal capacity is not as large, so they can ramp faster. So unfortunately, natural gas is quite expensive compared to coal. And this is an entire a political issue, but let's not talk about that. But natural gas, it's expensive. So when you observe these wind ramps, prices spike. And so all these ideas of moving into the smart grid is precisely trying to absorb these wind ramps instead of with natural gas plants, to absorb them through demand response or just cutting demands and sharing demands. So it is very important just to anticipate some of the loads, coordinate with demand response, and coordinate with the natural gas plants. So everything is done centrally. So as I said, if you lack of anticipation, then you have market volatility, price spikes, and also the more than the from the price point of view, from a physical point of view, you can also become highly vulnerable because what happens with these wind ramps is that if you shut down some of this wind supply, a very large wind supply in one of the nodes, then some of the other nodes will start becoming saturated or congested, some of the lines, and then the lines overheat and you can create blackouts. So right now, one of the things preventing absorption of wind in the United States is this lack of more efficient management. So in the next slide, in the next generation grid, I'm showing how things could potentially look like. So basically, you will still have your central plants, but now the consumers become more active participants. So you will have things like an apartment building, for example, or an office building, being equipped with some certain storage capacity that could be batteries, that could be ice storage, many different technologies. You could have fuel cells on site as well in some of these hospitals. You will have wind turbines. You could have compressor systems. So that what will happen is that you can make the demands of the buildings more flexible, and they will be observing the prices and deciding what to use when. So the central coordinator of the power grid will have power into mitigating some of these very quick demands or quick supply chain. From a market point of view, one of the trends that I'm observing is that ancillary services, what we call operating reserves, and will become more valuable assets. Right now, they're not as valuable, and you see the pricing is quite low. But when you actually demand these very quick ramps, when there's very high variations in supply, it's very like the market power that now the consumers will have will be so strong that they could actually get some revenues, very strong revenues out of cutting their demands. And especially it is not only about cutting demands in quantity, but cutting demands in frequency. So if you're able to cut demands very quickly, that becomes very valuable for the utility. One of the key observations here is that this very fast ramping property, we could potentially do it with some of the material inventories that we have in the chemical industry that some other facilities don't have, like apartment buildings or things like that. So in the next graph, in the motivation, I just have like just to show you, I guess, very quickly that the role that the chemical industry plays in the total electricity consumption is quite large. So the industry in general accounts for 20 to 25% of U.S. electricity demand. A lot of electricity goes into cement plants. A lot of it goes to steel plants and the chemical industry. So in particular, some curious cases that Lawrence Livermore were studying is that the two most important chemicals that where most electricity go is ethylene and ammonia. So those are potential very important players into electricity consumption. So from and also I forget a specialty air separation system. So that would be the third largest component. So electricity is consuming chemical sites, mostly for pumping, refrigeration, and lighting, and natural gas is used for steam and so on. So that's the motivation. So in the next slide, I'm now trying to move into market operations. So here in market operations, what most countries have now, most restructured countries, what they have is a central independent system operator, or what we call an RTO, a real-time operator.
Victor, can you listen to me?
Where you have a bunch of producers on the left.
Victor.
That can have a power plant based on coal and natural gas. They can have solar thermal. They can have whatever it is. And these generation companies or gencos bid into the market and say, okay, in the day-ahead market, they basically take bids one day prior to production, and they say, okay, for the next day, I can produce to you this much capacity potentially at this price. So they give a supply curve. And then on the other side, the utilities that are kind of representing the consumers, the utilities bid into the market also for demands. In some very large consumers, you don't need a utility, like a big site, like a power plant will directly be connected to the ISO depending on the demand and depending also if they need distribution capabilities. So a lot of this structure is defined based on a physical system where you have the transmission system and you have the distribution system. But anyway, so the utilities and gencos bid into the day-ahead market, and then this market is based on the forecast of demand for the next days, forecast of demands and forecasting bids. And then once actual production starts happening in real time, there are going to be changes in the forecast because the forecast is not perfect. So in order to absorb those variations, you can bid into the real-time market. And this happens depending on where you're located, but it can happen anywhere between 5 minutes to 2 minutes. The ISO, at each point in time, either if it's a day ahead on the real-time market, is going to set the prices by solving what they call a central dispatch or central unit commitment problem that I'm not going to talk about here, that basically will set the prices that maximize the social welfare for both the producers and consumers. So you can think about this problem probably more from a type of technology that we're familiar with as a model predictive control, where you look ahead 24 hours at the load, people bid, and then whatever happens, variations inside this window are going to be absorbed by a high-frequency controller that is a real-time market. So you're going to have your supply curves basically by the generators and the utilities. And pretty much in a very simple way, the intersection of supply and demand give you pretty much the clear price. So when you have multiple gencos and utilities, it's a little bit more complex than that. But that's the basic principle. And then basically these guys are going to keep bidding on and on a receding horizon basis. So there are some very interesting questions here on how you should be bidding, how prices are set. So I think one of the key observations here is just that in the day-ahead market, you have forward contracts. So you can say my expected demand for next day is going to be that. So basically you establish your bulk capacity or your bulk demand. For example, a coal plant will say this is going to be my bulk. And most of the times in forward contracts, the winners of the bids are low prices, low cost generation like coal and nuclear. And especially because also they cannot be ramped. So most of the day-ahead forward contracts are based on that. Now, in the real-time market, most of the time what happens is that the bids are won by generators that are very fast, like natural gas, because they are able to be ramped very quickly. So that's one of the key observations. So the price volatility in the real-time market depends on how fast you can ramp these natural gas generators. If you don't have enough ramping capacity, you will see that the prices will start spiking. So in the next slide, I'm just presenting just to illustrate what is the effect of ramping on prices. I've been working on some electricity market models using some concepts of predictive control. And so this is basically some game theoretical MPC type of problems, dynamic games. And here what you see is that in the real-time market, in the graph that I'm showing, in the real-time market, I am increasing the ramp capacity for the natural gas generators. So I go from a very low ramp, 0.1, to 1, 2, and 3. So I started increasing the ramping capacity and kind of making the grid more flexible from a dynamic point of view. So what you see is that when you have very high ramp constraints, very low ramp capacity, the prices go very, very high. So they can go from 80 cents, to basically $1.40 for kilowatt. So it can almost double the price. And this is some of the behavior that you see, especially that we have seen in the past in California, where you observe these very quick price spikes. And basically what is happening is either a generator is not able to provide sufficient ramping capacity because the forecast in the day-ahead market was really bad, or because the weather conditions are very strong and unexpected. And what you will see is these very high price spikes. So as I mentioned before, is just this ramping makes prices very volatile. So ramping capacity is a very important asset in this market. So traditionally, ramping has been thought of as a capacity that only generators have. And one of the cases that we're trying to make is that the utilities, implicitly through the consumers, can also provide sufficient ramping capacity to absorb these price spikes. So what will happen in the smart grid is that these price spikes will basically go down. So that's the entire motivation for the smart grid. Now let's move to the chemical industry. So here basically the question is if the chemical industry based on these market operations should be a price taker or should be a bidder. And everything depends on the utility structure. But I will claim that when you have a very large site, you have enough market power to convince the utility company to close a better contract for you. And this is something that you see, for example, in big cities like Chicago, where we actually have power into saying, you know what, like, we don't want these buildings to be charged like this. We prefer to be charged like that because you will get a benefit and I will get a benefit. So if you go with price taking, basically you will be looking at things like day ahead prices. You will be at the mercy of what are the prices that are happening in day ahead and also what is happening in real time and also the demand charges. So when you are doing your planning from operations point of view in the chemical plant, there's going to be quite a high uncertainty. Now, when you have, I'm sorry, I'm messed here with the animations. So when you have that price taking strategy, I'm showing in the graph below, based on some work of Larry and Kisitura and Brian, and some piping operations. So you see that the day ahead prices are quite smooth, because they're based on bulk electricity, but the real-time prices are wild. So you're pretty much like at the mercy of that. So and a strategy to mitigate that risk that you have in planning is to go with biddings. And for example, there's an interesting recent work of Manfred Morari where they're trying to manage or schedule some of these ovens for or some steel facilities based on day ahead and bidding, and they're tracking the profile in real time. And what happens is that since the day ahead prices are a little bit smoother and more stable, then you're able to basically also make your costs inside your operations more stable. So there's a potential here for mitigating the risk in planning for day-ahead operations or your planning operations, scheduling operations, by moving into the bidding-based structure instead of the price-taking structure. So as I mentioned before, we do have influence. Semiconductor companies, for example, have influence. Cement companies, chemical companies can have influence based on the demands. Now, there are interesting regulatory questions into how do we convince the utilities that this ramping capacity that the chemical plants, for example, have are an asset that we can exploit to decrease the price of inventories, to start thinking about inventories as an asset. But it is possible for us to start making a case, and that's some of the research that I'm doing, what would be the impact of doing this. But in the meantime, there are ways of just having different contracts with the utility. So some operational opportunities. I'm moving to the next slide. I'm just going to start just based on a recent project that we have in buildings. So buildings, you can pretty much think about it from an energy point of view as an industrial facility. The key difference is that we don't have inventories. So we have to play with some other variables in order to have this fast demand response that we need to satisfy the grid or to be less at the mercy of those grid prices. So basically, you will find that a building, and I'm moving to the next slide, a building in a very simple way, probably overly simple, the basic components of the building are an air handling unit that will be taking external air that is, let's say, during summer is very hot and with low CO2. Then this external air will enter the air handling unit. The air handling unit can decrease the temperature of this external air or can condition the air through electricity, through a refrigeration cycle, or it can be using chill water. So there are two ways of satisfying the cooling load necessary to cool down the external air to necessary conditions. One of them is you change the air volume or you change the delivery temperature. So you can provide the amount of cooling load based on those two variables. So there's some degree of freedom there. So you can think about this system over here as your central utility facilities. So then you have the conditioner comes out of the air handling unit, cold and in low CO2, and this conditioner is distributed to a bunch of variable air volume boxes. Most newer buildings operate this way. In some other, it will be a variable temperature, but they're not as efficient. So in variable air volume boxes, it's basically the actuators of the thermostats. So basically, you can think about it that way, where you have it supplies air to all these VAV boxes. Then the thermostat is in closed loop with the VAV box, and is trying to keep the temperature that we commanded into that particular zone. And the VAV box is just basically moving a damper to let air come in. until the temperature is raised. This close, this controller is always active, and it's very, its performance is very critical because we have a lot of heat generated inside the building because of occupants and because of computing equipment and lighting. So the thermostat is always measuring, sending the signals, and the BV boxes are continuously ramping the capacity of the conditioned air. Then basically we just extract the air from the zones that is going to be warm, and it's going to have high CO2 because of respiration of all the occupants. And basically we're going to return this air. A fraction of the air is going to be dumped, and a fraction of the air is going to be conditioned. It's going to be, basically mixed with external air to be conditioned. One of the main sources of waste of energy in buildings, in office buildings in particular, is that these thermostats are located in places where the occupants are not located. So, for example, you can think, if you follow my mouse pointer, you can think like if I'm seated on this opposite side of the room and the thermostat is on the other side, the distribution of temperature inside or of air inside the room is not homogeneous. It's not homogeneous. So the temperature that I perceive as an occupant is not the temperature that the thermostat is trying to control. So the BAV box is going to be continually supplying air, and I never feel it. So pretty much that part of the room is uncontrollable. So you can think about it that way. So that increases the demand. It's just basically just pumping air inside the room and doing nothing for you. So there's also another big source, and this is also very political. There's a non-necessary external air conditioning because we're reducing this return air. We're not reducing it as at a sufficient large capacity. So what happens is that there's a regulation set by ASHRAE that tells us that we need to recycle air at least 3 times inside an office building per hour. So that means that the entire volume of air that you have in your building is 3 times in an hour changed completely. And the regulation is based on the fact that it's an overly conservative regulation that says that we don't want occupants to be exposed to a very high concentration of CO2. Well, in reality, CO2 is never at a high concentration. It's very far from a high concentration in most buildings. But anyway, so there's a very large waste of energy through these air recycling systems. So that's something that hopefully will change in the future. Also, another thing is that the equipments are operated at low efficiency. So the fans and BAV boxes, they might be operated at capacities where basically it's not optimal to operate. So that's a big problem that you have also in chillers, that you have in boilers. I'm going to talk a little bit about boilers later. In central facilities, you are demanding electricity, and you might be demanding a negligible amount of energy, for example, in the form of steam or chilled water, that is forcing the chiller to be operated at a region where it's wasting a lot of energy. So there's no coordination between the deficiency of these systems and the actual demands that we're observing. That is the next case that I will make later in the chemical industry. So just from a control point of view, we're trying to push a little bit the ideas that have been around in the chemical industry, where you have a supervisory control. Most buildings, you'll be surprised, they don't have a supervisory control system. So basically what they have is an energy management system on top of everything that it doesn't pretty much do anything, but it serves as an interface to the operator. So it's a distributed control system, but they call it energy management system for whatever reason. So this is an interface where the operator comes and gives the set points, and it gives the set points to chillers, cooling towers, and air handling units. and it also gives the set points to all the sounds in the building, like the PAV boxes. And he tries to pretty much, he uses his experience as typical and say, well, today is rather hot, so I'm going to decrease the set point this way and this way. Well, one of the problems right now is when the prices start coming to the operator cannot be changing all these set points in a sufficiently high frequency. So these energy management systems are now trying to be equipped with some demand response capabilities, with some kind of planning capabilities. So you can think about this as an RTO system that looks ahead. So the idea here is that we're trying to push using some other predictive control concepts here to be used as a planner for the day ahead and say, well, weather is going to be like that, prices are going to be like that, I'm going to start decreasing my demands at this particular time. So being trying to be a little bit more proactive. And we're extending a little bit these ideas to not only a single building. So a building can have quite a large demand. So in the building that I'm seated right now, the bill is around $1 million a year just for HVAC. So we're 700 occupants. So if you will be able to decrease these demands by 10%, then, well, you're basically will be saving $100,000. So it's quite a lot of energy that is going into these buildings. Now, you can think about multiple buildings that now can also be coordinated with a central system in analogy with a site, in a chemical site. And then you will have the connection with the utility company. Well, now if I aggregate all these demands of the buildings, now I have the possibility of coordinating the demands and have a very large sharing potential for the utility in real time. And this brings benefits from a demand response point of view. And also coordination of all these building facilities enables running our central boilers and chillers at a higher efficiency. So, for example, if you need a negligible amount of steam for building one, and because of that negligible demand, you need to operate your boiler. You need to start up a new boiler or operate the boiler at a certain very low capacity. Then basically you are pretty much like burning the coal and sending all this waste energy from the combustion directly to the air. So there's some opportunities in coordinating all this with the utilities, central utilities. So I'm just going to go a little bit quicker here, but basically, you can pose these energy management systems and other predictive controllers. We're using some machine learning models because we're trying to make these type of systems cheap. So this is not like a chemical plant where you can afford very expensive control technology or more expensive. So here the savings have to be consistent with the cost of the technology. So if we go with very sophisticated models, then basically the economics don't work. So here what we're trying to trade off is comfort, energy demands, and CO2 emissions, and we're just trying to exploit sensor information. So just quickly a slide on how the things work. So basically the idea is to push some of the demands as much as possible away from some of the electricity demands that are going to conditioning air, trying to reduce them by exploiting the ambient air. So, for example, in this graph that I'm showing, if you follow my mouse pointer, is that in this pink line or magenta line, this is the current operation in the building. So you have the demand of electricity from the air handling unit. In blue, it's basically the ambient temperature. So you see a big changes. This is in September. So changes can happen between 50 Fahrenheit to 80 Fahrenheit in a single day. And you see that the ambient temperature remains very low, 50 Fahrenheit around night. So what is happening is that in the new system, it looks ahead using model predictive control, and it says, well, my demands more or less are going to be like that for the next day, so I can satisfy these demands instead of conditioning air. I am going to just use straight the ambient temperature to ventilate the building. So with that, we can delay the start of the air handling unit by almost 5 hours. And that's a big chunk of energy that you can save. And also we allow for some drifts of comfort during night. So that way we can save a lot of energy. So the savings for systems like this are something from 20 to 45%. It depends on climate. It depends on basically the type of building that you have, but normally around that range, 20 to 45%. So one of the important things for us is trying to identify zones where are demanding electricity that are unoccupied. So here we run an experiment. This is worked by some of my colleagues that basically they were trying to track some of the phone signals that we have in the building just to try to understand where occupants are in real time. And you see these big chunks so here, these little squares here are our air handling units. So you will see we have 7. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And so what you see is that a lot of occupants are not present in certain zones. So what we're trying to exploit is that knowledge to basically allow the system to drift the temperatures in those zones to kind of relax a little bit the set points. And with that, we can potentially save some energy. Now, let's go back to the chemical industry. So based on this analogy, one of the things that we don't have in buildings is that we don't have large inventories. We don't have a way of having operational flexibility. So because of that, we have to sacrifice comfort. Well, in chemical plants, you do have inventories, and those ones can allow you to change your production at a very high frequency, so you can still satisfy your demands of materials, while at the same time you can allow for a drift in electricity demand. So that provides a unique opportunity for market power. It allows very fast load shedding capacity, and also it allows you to start thinking about inventory as an asset and not necessarily as a cost. So I think that's very important. In order to do this, one of the things that I think required is there need to be coordination between the real-time optimization systems and the site-wide planning, and in particular, planning of inventories and planning of utilities. One of the things that is still not clear to me in chemical system operations is who manages the electricity, who manages energy, because the RTO system has normally an objective function that tries to minimize steam or tries to minimize a chill water, while the utilities, the central utilities, are trying to minimize electricity. So the price, there's some internal pricing structure in the chemical side that maps the electricity price into steam prices that can introduce inconsistency because you have different objective functions in the RTO and in the central utilities. So the question is, if we could coordinate these objective functions of RTO and the utilities, I think that could bring some benefits. Also, as part of the planning, you definitely need to be a little bit proactive, start thinking about the demands in a proactive manner, to plan ahead your demands, close contracts, close inventories, and then try to move to the real time. So for that, you need to assess loads of electricity, demands of electricity, as function of production levels, and potentially in some systems, weather is very important. manage risk in day ahead and real time bidding. And also, one of the things that we have found very useful, I don't know what the status in chemical plants, is that in at least in buildings, we don't know exactly how much electricity is going into different parts of the building. We don't know how much electricity is going into a particular chiller or into a particular fan or whatever it is. So because of that, we're not able to track these electricity demands carefully. And by installing better electricity meters, you can pretty much do a better job into understanding what is the particular electricity demand of a particular plant or a particular equipment unit, and that helps a lot into trying to figure out the demand behavior of the site and of each one of these units. And with that, you can discover how quickly they could ramp their demands down. So electricity metering is very important. Most of the times is handled in a central way. So I think it's very important to disaggregate these electricity demands. Just a little bit of a remark on that efficiency of boilers and chillers. It's different from optimization point of view to minimize energy and minimize energy cost. Actually, you'll be surprised that you can minimize energy cost by increasing your energy demand. So depending if you have a variable price structure, for example. So because of that, one of the key issues, for example, we as National Lab, we are forced not to minimize energy cost, but to minimize energy. And one of the main sources of inefficiency that we find is in the boilers and chillers. And the main inefficiency, so here in this graph you see, is that as a function of load, you have the efficiency of a particular boiler. For electric boilers, that are not that common in, I would say, in large sites. But for fossil fire boilers, you have changes from 50% to 80% in efficiency for those type of boilers. And you never really want to be ramping these things up and down all the time, like from scratch. So it's highly, highly inefficient to be ramping these boilers. So I think there's an opportunity there to coordinate the central demands of the RTOs to mitigate or to try to minimize the number of startups of these boilers. Otherwise, you're just like pumping CO2 straight to the atmosphere all the time. Another interesting observation, and I think I just have two more slides. Another interesting observation is the way electricity is priced from a quantity point of view. So there are opportunities for retrofitting generation. First, installing fuel cells in particular to mitigate some of the loads in buildings or some particular equipment. So I think that's why it's important to go into disaggregate metering, so that you could figure out that you could supply, for example, nowadays we have cogeneration of fuel cells that provide cogeneration capability, so they provide steam and electricity. So you could think potentially coupling this fuel cell to a particular system that requires steam, so that steam, if it's required in a fast basis, in a high frequency basis, instead of getting it from a central utility facility, you could potentially use the fuel cell. And it's a matter of questioning the economics of installation against the potential sharing capacity that you could have. And that's why it's very important to figure out what type of contract the site has. To figure if you don't have a good contract in place, then basically your fuel cell installation might not be feasible. So there's an experience that we have at one of the buildings in Argonne, where the fuel cell is pretty much operated at high capacity, pretty much at maximum capacity all the time, and because the price structure is not beneficial. So there are cases where we have questioned, well, let's go to a different price structure to find the benefits of this fuel cell and make the payback just shorter. Also, another opportunity is to decentralize demand charges. So most sites are charge from a central site point of view, and this might have to do with physical systems, because you need a set of transformers to basically ramp down the voltage of the electricity you're getting. But in certain systems, you don't need to do that. So it might be beneficial to charge for electricity through two different agents in a site. So if you have a site that is providing two different supplies of electricity to two different sets of plants, it is better to to disaggregate these demand charges. So here in this graph, I'm just showing how much would you be paying if you aggregate all your quantities. So the thing with demand charges is that they are nonlinear. If everything was linear, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all because the sum of the of demand charges is basically equivalent to the total demand charge. But if it's nonlinear, as is the most cases, piecewise linear or is quadratic, then basically there is an opportunity for disaggregating these demand charges. So those are basically the ideas. So just some conclusions. From a motivation point of view, the smart grid, as I mentioned, there's emphasis on ramping ancillary services, what they call, and demand elasticity. So it's very important to be able to decrease these demands quickly. The chemical sites could be valuable participants that we observe through the inventories potentially. There needs to be central coordination of RTOs and production planning. So that implies putting production planning objectives or RTO objectives in production planning or the other way around, or trying to make RTOs dynamic, which is a DRTO idea that has been around for some time. But I think that the central problem is just the coordination of the two. Production planning looks ahead, RTO does not look ahead. So I think that's a problem. From a models and algorithms point of view, I think a problem in planning that could make problems harder is that you have your long-term planner. You need somehow a day-ahead planner that captures short-time scales. So that could make problems complex. Utilities, real-time optimization, bidding formulations. So how do you couple planning now with the bidding decisions? So you have an extra variable into the bidding. So how much are you willing to demand and to shed at what cost, and to put that into the planning formulation that gives rise to complementarity type of problems, and it's complicated. Risk management is another issue. From a more probably regulatory, something that would be very beneficial for me in particular is to understand what is the current situation in the industrial sites, so that we could put a case together into what could be the potential shedding capacity of these industrial sites and what could be the role in the smart grid in very large industrial systems. And definitely a case like that could help the utilities to reevaluate how do they do these industrial billing structures. So you will see, if you go to the websites of the utility companies, you will see things that are all over the place. Some utilities, like PG&E, they give bidding. They provide bidding incentives. Some other utilities don't even mention it. So I think it's important in right now that everything is changing from a regulatory perspective, that it's important right now. I think it's the right time to make the case for this. So if you can just provide some quick comments on current status of billing structures, probably we don't have time right now, but if you want to drop me an email, that would be interesting. I could discuss with you about that. Current energy management practices, and also what are some of the federal mandates that some of these chemical sites or customers that you have are facing. So that's pretty much all that I have. So I'll be happy if you have any questions right now. Probably I went a little bit over time, but if you have questions right now, we can answer it, or if not, you can just drop me an email.
Okay.
So thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Victor, thank you very much for a great talk. We have a few minutes for questions, and maybe I can throw it off to the audience. Anyone out there?
No questions.
No questions. Okay.
Well, this is Ido, Victor. Hi.
Yep.
One quick question about these ramping costs.
Yeah.
What is the typical time scale when you expect
like this ramping to be have to be reactive. So if you have some case when you have to reduce some consumption, how much typical do you have time to react to those kind of requests?
So they are on less than an hour. It has to be pretty much less than an hour. So in the real-time market, you need less than 5 minutes. So there are different type of ramping capacities. So if, and that's exactly one of the points, that natural gas, it can ramp on the order of probably 5 to 10 minutes. So if you could potentially achieve something like that, you'll be in the game. You'll be in the real-time market game.
And on the consumer side, if say you want to do some demand response using a chemical plant for the flexibility,
yeah.
Would it be the same dynamics or would it be a bit slower?
In the chemical plants, you could probably achieve the same time scales as long as you have something that enables you to look ahead. If you have something that like RTO, it's a bit more difficult. But if you have something that is able to look ahead, like a motor predictive controller, you could potentially do it, because that's exactly the problem we have in buildings. So the building itself reacts very slowly. So I change my set points from 70 to 71, and it takes 2 hours to reach it. But when I have look ahead capabilities, then basically I can start the ramping down at ahead of time. So in the chemical plant, yeah, what I would say is that the timescales can be slower, but if you have look ahead, you can get into the market. You can get into the market.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, good. Other questions out there? Okay, if not, then thank you, Victor, again. These slides will be posted on the ESI website, and I'll send out a message when they're posted. And the audio will be available as well. And, Victor, thank you very much again. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, everyone.
Okay, bye-bye.
Have a good day.
Bye.
Bye-bye.